I will just explain to you that this is a discussion rather than a class. It's not a lecture. It's something that is using the words of the Buddha to stimulate thinking about how the Dhamma applies to our lives and how we can make sense of it in these modern day, modern times, and whether we maybe resonate with some or not. And of course, clarify any questions or doubts we might have around the teachings as well. So, in other words, it's a participatory session and it is for all of us here so we can explore the Dhamma together. So, today I wanted to talk about to take a sutta from the Brahmanavagga of the Majjhima Nikaya. It's the section where the Buddha speaks to various Brahmins, who were the kind of supposed highest caste in India in the Buddha's day and probably still today. And they were the kind of religious people who studied Sanskrit and were very learned and had a huge superiority complex, basically. So they thought they were the best, they were the fairest, they were just, the bee's knees. And they used to come to the Buddha and basically challenge him by saying that they were the best. And he, of course, was of a slightly lower caste, so-called lower of the Kshatriya caste, which is a kind of, mer not merchant, like the warrior caste. Also very highly respected in Indian society, but the Brahmins were the best. And it's very interesting to hear the Buddha's replies to this particular snotty young Brahmin who comes with all this arrogance. And perhaps we can take some lessons from this. The Buddha's showing us how to really question and overturn their views when they're wrong views. And he uses counter-questioning as a method to really kind of try and straighten out a person's view where their views are wrong or harmful, and also to kind of point out where they're contradicting themselves. So it can be quite entertaining. And I chose this particular sutta because I think, in today's times, at least the way we would believe things are happening through the news and social media, there's a lot of division and there's a lot of prejudice and discrimination on superficial things such as the way a person looks, the color of their skin, the so-called social status, the gender, the sexuality of a person, right? And in the Buddha's own time, 2600 years ago, he actually overturned all of these mistaken views of superiority or inferiority based on such superficial designations. So we really need to learn from the Buddha. And it's number 93, actually, not 91. Majjhima Nikaya number 93. And it's called Asalayana Sutta. Yeah. The chapter is the Brahmanavagga. The teachings connected with these Brahmins. And I like this because it's a little bit amusing as well. So basically, I will speak through some of this. It's several pages long. We may or may not get to the end. And you may raise your hands at any time. You may also write questions or comments in the chat box at any time. And at a convenient place, I will stop and come to you. Okay. Are you ready? And then we will begin. So this is the background to the sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. So the Blessed One is the Buddha, and Sarvati is modern-day Shravasti in northern India. You can still go there as part of a pilgrimage to India. There's nothing much there now, but it's still got an energy, and the Buddha lived there for about 12 years of his life, or at least 12 reigns, I think. Now, at that time, 500 Brahmins from diverse provinces were staying at Sarvati for some business or other. Then those Brahmins thought, this recluse Gotama, that's the Buddha, but a fairly derogatory way to refer to him, describes purification for all the four castes. In other words, that all four castes, whether they're the lowest caste of workers and sort of menial jobs, or the next caste, which are the merchants, the next caste of warriors or the Brahmins, the Buddha is saying that all four can purify their mind. Who is there able to dispute with him about this assertion? So the Brahmins want to argue this. They don't believe that is possible. Now, on that occasion, a Brahmin student named Atsalayana was staying at Sarvati. Young, shaven-headed, 16 years old, he was a master of the three Vedas, with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, and the histories as a fifth, skilled in philology and grammar. Don't even know what most of those words mean. And he was fully versed in natural philosophy and in the marks of a great man. Then the Brahmins thought, there is this young Brahmin student named Atsalayana staying at Sarvati. And then it repeats the whole thing. Young, shaven-headed, 16 years old, a master of basically everything, fully versed in natural philosophy and in the marks of a great man. He will be able to dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. You'd think so, right? If you've studied that much and you're an expert in the meaning of words and all the rest. So the Brahmins went to the Brahmin student Atsalayana and said to him, Master Atsalayana, this recluse Gotama describes purification for all the four castes. Let Master Atsalayana come and dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. When this was said, the Brahmin student Atsalayana replied, Sirs, the recluse Gotama is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now, those who speak the Dhamma are difficult to dispute with. I'm not able to dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. He's having his doubts. A second time, the Brahmin said, Master Atsalayana, blah, 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 blah. Please come and dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion, for the training of a wanderer has been completed by Master Atsalayana. So they think he can and he should be able to do this as part of his training. He's been trained for this, so it's time that he learns to dispute. Quite intimidating, isn't it? If you've got to go and argue with the Buddha. Even he knew this. And for the second time, he replied, No, the recluse Gotama is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now, those who speak the Dhamma are difficult to dispute with. I'm not able to dispute with the recluse Gotama. And they keep asking him, and eventually, for the third time, they ask, because in Buddhism, we always ask three times, we do everything in threes. Let the master Atsalayana come and dispute with the recluse Gotama about this assertion. For the training of a wanderer has been completed by Master Atsalayana. Let not the Master Atsalayana be defeated without having even fought the battle. When this was said, the Brahmin student Atsalayana replied, Surely, sirs, I'm not getting through to you when I say he is one who speaks the Dhamma. Now, those who speak the Dhamma are difficult to dispute with. I'm not able to dispute about this assertion. Still, sirs, at your bidding, I will go. You know what? That's what you'll have to do if I ask you to teach and I ask you two times, three times, you say, no, I can't teach the Dhamma. I say, and eventually you'll say, still, oh, well, at your bidding, I'll have to do it. But no, that is a bit rough, isn't it? Someone said here, it's a bit rough that the older Brahmins send the youngster out there to do their arguing for them. It's true, isn't it? But he is a master of his trade, supposedly. Yeah. Okay. Then the Brahmin student went with a large number of Brahmins, so he's going backed up here, to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, the Brahmins say thus. So this is what they believed in those times. And I would say possibly still today in India. I've lived there for about 15 years, best part of my adult life, at least most of it. Now I'm old, so it's about half of my adult life. And I would say these views are still very, very prevalent today. So this is what the Brahmins say. Brahmins are the highest caste. Those of any other caste are inferior. Brahmins are the fairest caste. Those of any other caste are dark. Only Brahmins are purified, not non-Brahmins. Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, the offspring of Brahma, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, and heirs of Brahma. What does the Master Gotama say about that? So this is the Buddha's reply. Now, Asalayana, the Brahmin women are seen having their periods, becoming pregnant, giving birth and giving suck. I love this translation. It's so down to earth. And yet those Brahmins, though born from the womb, say thus, Brahmins are of the highest caste. Blah, 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 blah. Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, the offspring, born of his mouth, born of Brahma, etc., etc., heirs of Brahma. Okay, so he's bringing it right back down to earth and saying that everybody is born in the same way. Whichever caste you're from, you're going to be born from a womb. There's really no distinction there. And it's pure myth, isn't it, to imagine that you're born from the mouth of God, basically. And there's evidence for this. Yeah. So then the young upstart says, although Master Gotama says this, still the Brahmins think thus. Brahmins are the highest caste. What else? Brahmins are superior. Brahmins are fair, other castes are dark, etc., etc., and only Brahmins are purified. So then the Buddha comes at another angle. What do you think, Asalayana? Have you heard that in Yoja and Cambodia, two different places, probably Cambodia's Cambodia, I would imagine, I'm not sure, and in other outland countries, there are only two castes, masters and slaves, and that masters become slaves, and slaves, masters. So I have heard, sir. Then on the strength of what argument or the support or with the support of what authority do the Brahmins in this case say the Brahmins are the highest caste, etc.? In other words, if this was really according to birth, according to the colour of our skin, etc., it wouldn't be possible. This would be a universal law throughout the world. And it would be intractable. You know, once you're born into one caste, that's the caste you're in forever. But in other countries, there are only two, the masters and the slaves, and these are interchangeable. One minute you're the master, the next you're the slave, the next you're the slave, or the next you're the master. No, the next you're the slave, and then you're the master. Basically, you know, our fortunes change, right? It's the same in monastic life. One minute you're the junior monastic, the next minute the abbot. Then you go to a big conference where there's all these senior monks, so you're the junior one, or senior bhikkhunis. And then you come back and you're the senior one again. So it's a role we take up. It's a designation, we can say. There's nothing inherent in that. So, but this wasn't cutting it. So he said, although the Master Gotama says this, still the Brahmins think Brahmins are the highest caste, etc. So the third argument, what do you think of Salayana? Suppose a noble were to kill living beings. That means a Brahmin, actually, in this context. To take what is not given. To misconduct themselves in sensual pleasures. To speak falsely, speak maliciously, speak harshly. Gossip, be covetous, have a mind of ill will and hold wrong view. On the dissolution of the body after death, would only this person, be likely to reappear in a state of deprivation in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Oh, sorry, it was a different caste. A noble might be the Kshatriya then, the next caste down. Okay. So suppose somebody who was not a Brahmin were to do all these things. Would only that person appear in an unhappy destination and not a Brahmin who did the same things? Suppose a merchant were to do these things. That's the third caste. Suppose a worker were to do these things, to kill living beings, take what's not given, misconduct themselves in sensual pleasures, speak falsely, maliciously, harshly, gossip, covetous, mind of ill will, and hold wrong view. On the dissolution of the body after death, would only they be likely to reappear in the state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, and even in hell, and not a Brahmin? No, Master Gotama, whether it be a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker, all four castes who kill living beings, etc., and hold wrong view, on the dissolution of the body after death are likely to appear in deprivation, an unhappy destination, perdition, and even in hell. So basically, the law of karma is the same for all. Bad actions lead to a lot of suffering, whether you believe in afterlife or not. We can know for ourselves, can't we, that if we speak in unwholesome ways, if we conduct ourselves in unwholesome ways, hopefully none of us know what it's like to actually kill. But then again, we may have killed animals, right, or small beings, and we know it doesn't feel good, actually. You know, and holding wrong view here is a cause for being born in an unhappy destination. One of those wrong views is that there's no karma. You can do whatever you want and it doesn't matter. You die and that's the end of it. That's another wrong view. In other words, there's no consequence to one's actions. There's no impact of our actions on others. That's a wrong view that leads to us breaking all those precepts, leads to us conducting ourselves wrongly. And this is very common, isn't it? Especially in cultures that don't grow up with, you know, a strong spiritual path, like say, a spiritual practice, that we kind of think, well, you know, there's probably nothing anyway after death. So why don't we just enjoy ourselves to the max? Just get whatever we can out of life, maybe do the best we can, but really geared towards happiness and pleasure that's instant and immediate, right? And and is for ourselves. And that's how many of us live our lives, isn't it? And yeah, we kind of cut corners here and there on our ethics sometimes. We kind of compromise that because we think it'll be worth it in the long run for ourselves. So this is one of the wrong views that was common also in the Buddha's day. So the young Brahmin had to accept that basically anyone who kills, whatever caste they're from, they're going to have the same results. It's going to cause them to suffer in this life and the next. Are there any questions or comments so far? Yes. Come to Georgia.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. Hey. Yeah, this is a really interesting one because
yeah.
I think these days people hold much more tightly to their views, you know? And I think my question really is around how we keep our heart open to those who don't wish us well for some reason. Do you think they are better than us? You know, like, kind of very difficult to kind of think kindly about the men putting up, who have literally picked up England flags just down the street.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm also interested in your journey kind of navigating that as a bhikkhuni when people think maybe you shouldn't have ordained, you know, certain monks, or that's an assumption.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great question. Thank you. So, you know, how do we navigate people holding views that we do view as harmful and that we can sometimes experience as harmful in our own personal lives, such as people who, you know, don themselves in the British flag. A lot of the time, I think, it's trying to understand where they're coming from to some degree, but only to the degree that it helps us to open our heart, as you say. Sometimes it's very difficult to understand where they're coming from, and we can go into a whole spin about how terrible this is. Are they so ignorant? Don't they realize how it's hurting others? Da 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 da. And then we just wind ourselves up more because we're giving too much attention to people who are, you know, behaving in harmful ways. But sometimes, if we are in a sort of balanced state of mind and we're genuinely open to trying to understand, we can, I mean, even read on social media that some people do insist that they are just being patriotic and they don't mean to be racist. It's just that they haven't added two and two together and tried to think a bit deeper, you know, about the sort of message that puts out to others and why people of colour particularly, or people who are so-called immigrants or aren't even immigrants but just aren't white men or women, or aren't straight or aren't, you know, identifying in a binary gendered way, they don't have an understanding of how that creates such fear and such a sense of being unwelcome. And I know a person who actually does go on marches like this, and she's very upset that some people think she's racist because of that. She's very upset by that because she's not. Or at least she doesn't think she is. But there's a difference between not being racist and having empathy for how that affects others who aren't, don't have white privilege, right? Or don't have heteronormative privilege or male privilege or whatever other privilege there is. So I think that helps me to realise that most people that do these things are not actually coming through maliciousness, but more through delusion. But still, it doesn't make it any easier to bear, because delusion and ignorance are actually incredibly dangerous. You know, if you are very easily manipulated, which we are as human beings, and you get in with the wrong crowd, then it's dangerous. And I think for me, it's like, sometimes I can do something about that situation, but sometimes it just makes me feel that I need to commit more to my own way of living in the world, and to make sure I do incorporate other people's views and don't allow my heart to close, but at the same time, really bring forward a different value and make that very, very obvious to people. So, you know, for example, our website, we say that we're open to people. We're not open. We welcome and rejoice in diversity, right? And we welcome people from the LGBTQIA plus community. And don't just say it, but do it. You know, make them feel welcome and get to know people and where they're coming from and who they are. And, you know, even for people that have very overtly racist views, it seems that if they get to know somebody, sometimes they do have the one Latino friend. I don't think you can say Latino anymore. Latinx, I don't know how they...
Hispanic.
Sorry, Hispanic, yeah. Friend, this is in America, so a documentary by... what's his name? Louis Theroux, years and years ago. And there were these people that were very, very racist, by any stretch of the, you know, by anybody's measurement. And yet they would have the one, you know, friend from Mexico, or the one black friend, and they'd be like, oh, yeah, but that's George or whatever. And it just, the cognitive dissonance there, you know, but it's fear of the unknown, it's fear of differences. And that's why I wanted to read this Sutter. There's another one that I'd like to read out too, that basically says these superficial differences don't distinguish human beings from one another in any way. Like in the animal realm, animals are distinguished on the basis of birth and species, but humans are one species. And differences in mating, differences in voice, which could mean language, could mean tone of voice, right? Women speak differently from men. Difference in, so mating, which is sexual orientation, voice, colour, what else was there?
Bodily features.
They're actually just verbal designations. They're actually meaningless when it comes to awakening. Yeah. I don't know if I really answered your question.
Yeah, so it's like getting really clear about our values and ethics and really living that rather than focusing on trying to change other people. It's kind of what I've heard.
Yeah, I think that's one part of it. I mean, I do think we can try to understand other people and try to think of them in a way that's maybe charitable, but also recognises when genuine harm's being caused. And sometimes we can address that harm. You know, you can go on a different march Or you can give funds to certain charities that work at supporting vulnerable or marginalised communities. Or you can, if you're fortunate, even have conversations with people, but it takes a lot of skill. Yeah, but I don't think it's helpful to kind of. Yeah, I find it incredibly triggering to read very racist or misogynistic comments, say on Facebook, like, you know, there'll be a post about something terrible that's happened. And people say, oh, well, you know, that person did something wrong, so they deserved it. And it's just, yeah, at some point I feel so upset by that that I just don't look at it anymore. And I just try to understand that this is, it's easy to say those things when there's no consequence. I don't really believe people are that heartless, and the vast majority of people are not. They're really not. But we don't speak up enough. You know, people with more moderate views don't speak up enough, and I think we need to use our voice. Yeah. But yeah, very important question. Thank you. It's important that we don't start thinking in very polarized ways. I mean, obviously now our values, but try not to think of people as other, because sometimes we actually want the same thing. We just have different ideas about the solutions. And a lot of the time it's a lack of education on the part of people who are voting without really knowing what they're voting for, you know? Yeah. And a subjectivity to being manipulated. I mean, there are people that are more easy to influence, and I think we have to be very, very humble about how that is, all of us to some degree, but also knowing our values can make us less easy to manipulate, I think. Yeah. Coming to Kathleen. Hi.
Thank you.
You're quite quiet. Is there any way you can turn up your volume? So it's a bit difficult to hear you.
Oh, yo, yo. Is that better?
It's better, but it's still very quiet.
Oh, hold on.
But I can hear you.
Wrong button. I was kidding. Okay, this now?
That's a bit better, yeah. Okay. Yeah, if you hold the mic towards your mouth, it should
okay.
Work. Yeah.
It's practically in my mouth now.
Yeah, okay. I think it needs to be. Yeah, that's good though.
All right. I'll just eat it then.
Yeah.
Wanting to pick up on this thing you just said about lack of education, it's a tricky issue because I've often thought, particularly the way in which I approach, because of my background, the way I've approached the Buddhist teachings, I just sort of swallow books whole, and I'm very keen to learn all the ins and outs of the teachings and to internalize them and all the rest of it. And in some ways, on some levels, it's fairly complex stuff,
yeah,
to some extent, compared to the ordinary kinds of lives which many of us lead. And it's not everyone, perhaps, who can engage at that level with the teachings. And I kind of don't like the idea, though, I guess it's just not wanting to be part of an elite. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And actually,
any thoughts about that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, learning the Dhamma doesn't mean learning the teachings intellectually. Learning the Dhamma really means learning to handle our emotional world, I would say, with some skill and some wisdom and compassion. The teachings.
Yeah, but that takes a little bit of, that takes, even to have that thought, I need to address my emotions, even
though it's
fairly.
I know. It's a privilege. It's a privilege to be in a position to be able to do that. I mean, that's another way we can have compassion for those who can't, right? Because a lot of the time it's because they're working hand to mouth, they're living hand to mouth. And they're literally just going out to feed a family. Maybe they're a single mother, or they've got a very sort of, you know, minimum wage job or whatever, and it's about survival. And then some big leader comes along and says, you know, the reason that it's so hard for you is because of these other people who don't look like you. And before it was much better in the other deputies. And you know, maybe they believe that because they don't really understand what the government, the policies are, you know, that they're going to like undermine the NHS and the public services, and they're not actually your friend. They're being funded by billionaires. So yeah, it's understandable, you know, both that people wouldn't have the time or the means or capacity, perhaps even, to really sit with themselves and look at what's going on inside. And also they might be easy people to manipulate, right? Because
yeah, there's also a lot of very educated people who have quite obvious views.
Absolutely.
I wonder whether they're perhaps, you had this phrase living hand to mouth, perhaps on an emotional level, living hand to mouth.
That's a good point, yeah. It's interesting you said that, because one time I was driving up here, I mean, not me, but one of my friends who's now a trustee was driving me up Boars Hill, and people were not smiling when we were past them, you know, on the lanes. And it's a very rich area. And she said, wow, that's impoverished. They can't smile, that's impoverished. And it was just such a great sort of ironic play on words, you know, that you can be so wealthy and yet so disconnected that you're not able to just smile. I mean, they were literally frowning, this particular person, like kind of glaring. But, you know, my little theory, because I've looked at sort of polls where they talk about people who vote for one person over another, and there is some differentiation in terms of education, but it's not absolute. So some people who are highly educated may still vote for things that aren't in most people's best interest, right, or even their own. And I started thinking, is it more that actually, you can't really test this so well, but is it more likely that if people have travelled widely and met people from other cultures, especially at a younger age, that might be a better kind of measure, or compared to people who've never left their hometown, it might be a very white area, for example. Is that more of an indication of these kind of views, you know? And that will correlate to some extent, you see, with education, but not completely. So I think that is a really important part of things, is like just meeting one another. And this is going for everybody here, right? Don't just stay in your own communities. Like, if you can't go, say, to Palestine, which some people do, you know, and they actually meet and live with people and try to be a human shield, it's really amazingly inspiring. Or they go with Doctors Without Borders, you know, or they go to Sudan. I mean, or they send, like, tons of resources to Myanmar or whatever. If you can't actually go there, you can still read about people in those cultures, get to learn their cultures, get to learn their values, read poetry, humanize people who are different from ourselves, you know? And often you don't have to necessarily read the literature of like tyrants or dictators, but often if you learn a bit about their lives, they've been traumatized, they've been abused. You know, and that can help us understand where damaging views are coming from. They're usually coming from people who've been damaged. Yeah. But yeah, if we do have the privilege to sit and meditate and learn the Dhamma, please don't feel guilty about that, because you can be a source of inspiration and light for others. Yeah. I'm saying that for everybody, you know, because... Yeah, it's also good to recognize and be honest about our privileges, isn't it? And then think about how we can use those to support other people. Because we all have some privileges, all of us here. Benjamin.
Hello.
Hi.
Just thinking about the last two questions, a couple of things occurred to me. And you mentioned reading poetry from other cultures. The poet Rumi wrote to... out beyond ideas of right and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there.
Mm.
And that relates to what, excuse me, that relates to what I was thinking about the first question, about how to engage with people who have harmful views or views we disagree with. And I read a really fascinating book a while ago by a chap called David McRaney called How Minds Change.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked into the science of that, but also much more interesting to me, he went and met people who had had success in changing minds on political issues. So he went and met with groups who had had really astonishing success in changing people's minds in the US on gay marriage. And people who had dead set against it became to be for it. And the overall thrust of the book, what I got from it, was that when people are successful in changing minds, The way they get there is through first establishing a rapport with the person.
Yeah.
And then having a conversation in a spirit of open inquiry.
Yep.
So they don't actually try and argue. They don't actually try and put their own point across. They just genuinely ask out of interest what the person thinks, why they think it. And then they ask a few little questions that just put a seed of doubt in the mind, like, have you met someone who this is relevant to? Have you met a gay person? Whatever the issue is. And these little questions just get people thinking, and you have the opportunity to give them a moment where they can reflect, maybe for the first time ever, and they change their own mind. Or they don't. It doesn't always work. But it has an amazing rate of success from what I was reading in there.
Yeah. And how wonderful.
That this is very similar to how we see the Buddha engage with people in these kinds of suttas. Because he never says, no, you're wrong, it's like this. He says, what do you think is such and such, so and so?
Exactly.
These questions to get people to change their own mind.
Exactly. Yes, and that's exactly what's happening here. That's really beautifully put. Maybe you could share the name of the book and the even the poem if you've got time to do that. That would be wonderful. Yeah, that's really great. If I can mute you so that... There you go. Yeah, and it brings to mind another person who I admire greatly, but I can't be sure of her name. I think it's Dia Khan. Is that right? Dia Khan? I'm pretty sure. She's extraordinary. She's... I think from a Muslim background, and she's made a lot of films, and one of them is she goes to an incredibly, basically to meet members of the Ku Klux Klan in America, and she talks to them, listens to them, treats them as people. I think what you're saying about listening and asking them questions can put people at ease, and it's almost like when their nervous systems start to calm down, they open up and become more receptive. And she actually, one of the leading members of the Ku Klux Klan, actually changed their views completely and now travels around the world with her. She calls him her brother and is involved in anti-racist work. It's really amazing. I'm going to write her name down anyway because I ought to know it, and it's something like this, and I'm hoping that people might be able to find her from that. You could put in, I don't know, filmmaker or something, documentary maker. But I find her amazingly inspiring. And it sounds very similar to what you shared. Thanks for that. Yeah, really admirable. But again, you know, that I don't know if she meditates or if any of these people meditate. They obviously practice. I don't know what they'd call their practice. Practice being centered, practice being embodied themselves, but I think it does start from there. You know, we need to learn to be genuinely open, and that involves being able to sit with difficult feelings inside ourselves. Yeah, beautiful. All right, well, shall we see another example of this in this sutta of the questioning and counter-questioning? So this young Brahmin still insists on his view, but the Buddha is patient and continues. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a Brahmin were to abstain from killing living beings, from taking what's not given, from misconduct in sensual pleasures, from false speech, malicious, harsh speech, and from gossip, and were to be uncovetous and have a mind without ill will and hold right view. On dissolution of the body after death, would only they be likely to reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world, and not a noble, a merchant, or a worker? So this is the opposite scenario. No, Master Gotama, whether it be a noble or a Brahmin, or a merchant or a worker, all four castes who abstain from killing living beings, etc., and hold right view, on the dissolution of the body after death, are likely to reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. So then the Buddha says, then on the strength of what argument, or with the support of what authority, do the Brahmins in this case say thus, Brahmins are the highest caste, etc., heirs of the Brahma? So now he's getting a little bit more questioning, right? On what grounds? So that's a little bit like Benjamin said, you know, asking, what are your examples, right? But here he's asking on whose authority, in other words, where are you getting your information from? Although Master Gautama says this, still the Brahmins think we are the highest caste, etc. So he still doesn't feel the argument strong enough, or maybe not strong enough to convince his Brahmin friends. So then the Buddha asks further, what do you think, Asalayana? Is only a Brahmin capable of developing a mind of loving kindness towards this region without hostility and without ill will? And not a noble or a merchant or a worker. No, Master Gautama. Whether it be a noble, a Brahmin, a merchant or a worker, all four castes are capable of developing a mind of loving kindness towards this region without hostility and without ill will. Then on the strength of what argument or with the support of what authority do the Brahmins in this case say that the Brahmins are the highest caste, etc., and the heirs of Brahma? I mean, it's good, isn't it, that at least they understand everyone can develop loving kindness. And I guess, okay, maybe we don't have that understanding if we've not been born in the Buddha's day or into Buddhist culture, that it's possible to cultivate loving kindness. But I guess we all know people who are loving, right, from every walk of life or many walks of life. We know that it's possible, right, for any human being to develop these things. Okay, the next one's quite funny, because the next one, I'll just give you a little bit of a background. So in the Brahmin culture at that time, and even today, you might have heard of something called the Kumbh Mela in India. Has anyone heard of that? The Kumbh Mela, it happens every 4 years, I think. And there's about, I forget, is it 12 million? It's a lot of millions of people, like especially so-called holy men, mostly. In other words, people who live aesthetic lives. Aesthetic lives, not aesthetic. And at that time, they all go down to the River Ganges, which is believed to have cleansing powers. And people believe this so much that they think that if they take a bath in the River Ganges, they purify all their sins and then they're bound to go to heaven. So in other words, you can do whatever you like in your life, but as long as you can go and take a dip in the river, in the Ganges, with all its filth and sewage, you will purify your mind. So, and at those Kumbh Melas, it's kind of shocking because there's often even stampedes to get down to the river's edge. There's so many millions of people, you know, desperate, frenzied about getting in. So the next one relates to that belief, which was obviously there in the Buddha's day. What do you think, Asalayana? Is only a Brahmin capable of taking a loofah and bath powder, going to the river and washing off dust and dirt, and not a noble, a merchant or a worker? I think that's really funny. Everyone can wash their armpits, right? And if you do that in a holy river, then, well, it should have the same effects on everyone. How does the river know what caste you're from? No, Master Gautama, whether it be a noble, a Brahmin, a merchant or a worker, all four castes are capable of taking a loofah and bath powder, going to the river and washing off dust and dirt. Then on what strength, the strength of what argument or with the support of what authority do the Brahmins in this case say, Brahmins are the highest caste, etc., and heirs of the Dhamma? Still, he's not convinced. Do you want more? You can raise your hand at any time if it's going too fast. Actually, the next one doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe I'll skip the next one. Well, it's, I suppose, interesting, but maybe I'll skip it for the sake of seeing how far we can go here. All right, let's go to the next one. What do you think, Asalayana? When a fire is lit and heat is produced by someone in the first group. Which one? Okay, that's part of that one. Okay, I'm going to the next one now. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a noble youth were to cohabit with a Brahmin girl. This is intermarital, intercaste marriage or cohabitation. And a son was born from their cohabitation. Should a son born from a noble youth and a Brahmin girl be called a noble after the father or a Brahmin after the mother? He could be called both, Master Gautama. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a Brahmin youth were to cohabit with a noble girl and a son were to be born from their cohabitation. Should the son born from a Brahmin youth and a noble girl be called a noble after the mother or a Brahmin after the father? He could be called both, Master Gautama. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose a mare were to be mated with a male donkey and a foal were to be born as the result. Should the foal be called a horse after the mother or a donkey after the father? It is a mule, Master Gautama, since it does not belong to either kind. I see the difference in this last case, but I see no difference in either of the former cases. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose there were two Brahmin students who were brothers, born of the same mother, one studious and acute, and one neither studious nor acute. Which one of them would Brahmins feed first at a funeral feast, or at a ceremonial milk rice offering, or a sacrificial feast, or a feast for guests? On such occasions, Brahmins would feed first the one that was studious and acute. For how could what is given to one who's neither studious nor acute be grapefruit? Okay, so now he's getting closer and closer to getting caught out. So it's all building up. What do you think, Asalayana? Suppose there were two Brahmin students who were brothers, born of the same mother. One studious and acute, but immoral and of bad character. And one neither studious nor acute, but virtuous and of good character. Which one of them would Brahmins feed first at a funeral feast or a ceremonial milk rice offering or sacrificial feast or a feast for guests? On such occasions, Brahmins would first feed the one who was neither studious nor acute, but virtuous and of good character. For how could what is given to one who is immoral and of bad character bring great fruit? So he's changed his tune now. He didn't take into account a person's character. So the Buddha says, first, Asalayana, you took your stand on birth. And after that, you took your stand on scriptural learning. And after that, you've come to take your stand on the very ground that purification is for all four castes, as I describe it. When this was said, the Brahmin student Asalayana sat down, silent and dismayed, with shoulders drooping and head down, glum and without response. Knowing this, the Blessed One said to him, once, Asalayana, when seven Brahmin seers were consulting together in leaf huts in the forest, this pernicious view arose in them. Brahmins are the highest caste and all the rest of it. They are the superior ones, others are inferior. They're the fair ones, others are dark, etc. They're heirs of the Brahma born from his mouth. Now, the seer Devala and the dark heard of this. Devala the dark heard of this. This must be some famous person at that time. Then he arranged his hair and beard, dressed in ochre-coloured garments like this, put on stout sandals and, taking a staff made of gold, appeared in the courtyard of the seven Brahmin seers. Then, while walking up and down the courtyard of the seven Brahmin seers, the seer Devala the dark spoke thus, where have those worthy Brahmin seers gone? Where have those worthy Brahmin seers gone? Then the seven Brahmin seers thought, who is walking up and down in the courtyard of the seven Brahmin seers like a village lout, speaking thus, where have those worthy Brahmin seers gone? Where have those worthy Brahmin seers gone? Let us curse him. Then the Brahmin says, curse the seer, devil of the dark. Be ashes, vile one. Be ashes, vile one. But the more the seven Brahmins cursed him, the more comely, beautiful, and handsome the seer, devil of the dark, became. Then the seven Brahmin seers thought, our asceticism is in vain. Our holy life is fruitless. For formerly when we cursed anyone, thus, be ashes, vile one, be ashes, vile one. He always became ashes. But the more we curse this one, the more comely, beautiful and handsome he becomes. Okay, I'm going to pause here because it goes on quite a lot further, although not too much further. Are we all good? Should we ask any questions or shall we just keep going and get to the end of this story?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Your asceticism is not in vain, sirs. This is Devil of the Dark. Your holy life is not fruitless, but sirs, put away your hatred towards me. We've put away our hatred towards you, sir. Who are you? Have you heard of the seer, Devil of the Dark, sirs? Yes, sirs. I am he, sirs. Then the seven Brahmin seers went to the seer, Devil of the Dark, and paid homage. Then he said to them, sirs, I heard that while the seven Brahmin seers were dwelling in leaf huts, this pernicious view arose in them. Brahmins are the highest caste, the fairest, the superior, etc., born of the mouth of Brahma, heirs of Brahma. That is so, sir, said the Brahmins. But, sirs, do you know if the mother who bore you went out only with a Brahmin and never with a non-Brahmin? No, sir. But, sirs, do you know if your mother's mother back in the seventh generation went only with Brahmins and never with non-Brahmins? No, sir. But, sirs, do you know if the father who begot you went only with a Brahmin woman and never with a non-Brahmin woman? No, sir. Do you know if your father's father back to the seventh generation went only with the Brahmin women and never with non-Brahmin women? No, sir. But, sirs, do you know how the descent of an embryo comes about? Sir, we know how the descent of an embryo comes about. Here there's the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season and the Gandharva is present. That's like the sort of consciousness of the child to be. This is how they believed. Thus, the descent of an embryo comes about through the union of these three things, the union of mother and father and this Gandharva. Then, sirs, do you know for sure whether that Gandharva is a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker? Sir, we do not know for sure whether that Gandharva is a noble or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker. Because remember, they believed in, you know, people from previous lives, so it must have been something, right, this little new being. That being so, sirs, then what are you? That being so, sir, we do not know what we are. This is called an identity crisis. Now, Asalayana, even those seven Brahmin seers, on being pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by the seer Devil of the Dark on their own assertion about birth, were unable to support it. But how shall you, on being pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by me now on your assertion about birth, be able to support it? You who rely on the teacher's doctrines are not even fit to be their spoon holder. So the Buddha's pretty condescending. Let's say pretty direct. When this was said, the Brahmin student Asalayana said to the Blessed One, magnificent, Master Gotama, magnificent, Master Gotama. From today, let Master Gotama now, not just Gotama, remember me as a lay follower, has gone to him for refuge for life. So he's turned this young Brahmin around. And obviously this young Brahmin has an appreciation for the Buddha's wit and wisdom and the common sense of his argument. And he's been pretty impressed. And it's quite interesting because most of the suttas in this section of the Majjhima Nikaya of this particular book, show the Buddha having great success. And, you know, this young Brahmin said, didn't he, to his elder Brahmins all along, I won't be able to dispute, don't make me go, don't make me go. But they pushed him to go. And this is what happens, they lose their disciples. So, so if any of you are like pushing your partners to come to Anukampa Grove, be careful. They might not come back. They might shave their heads and ordain, you never know. Excellent. Wow, we actually got through the whole thing. I just left out one passage, which was a sort of story that was a little complicated. That's number 11. It's part 11 in the sutta. So you can go back and read it if you wish. And it will be online, Majjhima Nikaya number 93. Excellent. So how about that? Are you convinced? If you did have any prejudice, hopefully it's all gone. And yeah, what makes us truly human and able to connect and see one another's humanity is the practice of loving kindness and the purification of the mind. We're all capable of doing this. Even the other day I was teaching on this subject pretty much to, I think it was their group, to Buddhism.net on inclusivity and the way that Buddha established an inclusive community from the outset by design, by intention. And somebody there said something about, isn't it harder basically to become enlightened as a woman, or what was it exactly? Something like that. Oh, isn't female birth inferior? She'd been told that female birth was inferior. Can you believe this? By, I think, monastics, probably male monastics, probably, right? But unfortunately, some female monastics and female lay people also in countries which are deeply patriarchal and have inherited these beliefs, they sometimes have this view that women's birth is inferior. And I said that the Buddha said that human birth is an absolute privilege. The human birth is an exceptional birth, a very, very incredible opportunity to learn the Dhamma and to become fully enlightened. All human beings have the capacity to do that, no matter their caste, no matter their gender. That is all irrelevant to awakening, completely irrelevant and inconsequential. And to think that any human birth is not a good one is actually flying in the face of the Buddha's teachings. It's absolutely wrong. And of course, there were many, many enlightened nuns in the Buddha's day, hundreds, if not thousands, of fully awakened arahats. And also really chief lay women too, who were like more advanced than some of the monks. And there was one lay woman who was supporting a couple of monks most of her life. And they were meditating in the forest on a mountaintop. And at the end of their lives, they all died, of course, she found that she was in a much higher realm than them. And she went down to scold them. What have you been doing? You've been meditating all that time. I've been cooking for you, feeding you. And what have you been doing? You've been messing around. So, you know, actually, there's no such difference at all between human beings. It's just how much we're exposed to the Dhamma and how well we practice the path, right? Starting in Sila. Are your Buddhism.net talks available somewhere online, and did Ajahn Suchato turn up in the end? In the very end, as in on the day when his session had been cancelled, he turned up. And the organisers were not impressed and said, Ajahn, we've been trying to contact you for 2.5 months. Where did you go? We've already told you that it's cancelled. And Ajahn Chanda's doing it now. And so, no, not really. He didn't really turn up, or let's say he turned up last minute and a bit too late. Yeah, so no. So it was just me, but I don't know. People said it was a good talk because I only had half an hour to get through the subject of inclusivity, so it was kind of point, 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 point. It was in brief, which is why I wanted to bring this sutta in full today, because I only touched on this sutta like as a paraphrase. It will be available on their website, and it will be linked to our website as well, to our YouTube channel, once they have it ready. Does pushing the Dhamma pushing to the Dhamma help, or is it better to ask questions and be late? Yeah, I think number two, because remember, it's not about what we say, it's about our lives and how we live and how we exemplify or embody the Dhamma, right? It's about who we are rather than anything else. But I think this is also where our own wisdom comes in. Sometimes a person might be receptive to some Dhamma, but you don't have to make it sound Buddhist or scriptural. You know, you can make it sound just human, like human principles, like, oh, how does it feel to be kind? You know, I remember a time I was really kind. Maybe I was thinking at the time that somebody didn't deserve my kindness, but then I was kind anyway, and it really had a powerful effect. And then I noticed that person was, you know, more well-disposed to me next time. That kind of thing. You can just tell it in your own anecdotal way, but you don't have to make it sound as though you're, like, pushing anything, because that tends to turn people off. And even for monastics, we're supposed to, you know, the Buddha didn't want people to proselytize and to go out and kind of preach. He wanted people to come to us and ask for the teachings, and that was one of the reasons that he advised, well, he set up monastics to be alms mendicants, so that the people who wanted to support would come and offer food, and then they would almost be telling you they were receptive, right, to hearing the Dhamma. They'd be expecting a teaching, in fact. And it's true that the people who come here and stay here and, you know, support the Sangha, they tend to get more exposure to the Dhamma, right? Because I'm not going to go out and look for disciples, believe me. Ajahn Brahm always says it's his job to get rid of disciples, not to gain more, and I think it's the same for me. We don't look for work. But if people want to come to this, then great. I assume you want to hear it because you're here. Okay. Anything from anyone else? How is it for some of the newbies? Was it interesting? Was it too technical or strange? Or was it? It's not like a sort of standard sort of like the doctrine as such, but it's an interesting, an interesting sutta to show us how the Buddha lived and practiced and how he dealt with people with different views and spread this idea of equality. Asalayana was kind of being pushed. Yeah, I mean, he was being pushed by the Brahmins, but not to learn the Dhamma, right, but to debate with the Buddha. And it was kind of an unexpected, result that came about. So that was just, if you ask someone to go to the Buddha, I mean, you know, it's the Buddha. Imagine his love and compassion. I mean, it would have been so powerful. You know, he just knew exactly how to handle people, how to draw them in, gain their trust, and then turn them around. And there was no hint of judgment or ill will. So he would have felt completely inspired, I mean, uplifted, suffused with loving kindness. The Buddha's loving kindness and compassion would have been just immense. So, yeah, by the Buddha, I think. This is what happened in his day. I mean, it was part of Indian culture to go and debate with people from different religions, so that was just part of what used to happen. All kinds of ascetics would debate with other ascetics, so of course they would turn around their views. And they wanted to understand. I mean, I think that's still alive in India. It's not such a kind of culture that follows what someone else says. Like, most of Southeast Asia is a lot more passive in that sense, but India's always been quite a strong democracy and I think a place where people really inquire and explore and search for meaning. The ways of karma are unpredictable. Yeah, that's right. I mean, what sort of karma to be living in the time of a Buddha? And hey, guess who else is living in the time of a Buddha? Do you know? You don't know that you're all living in the time of the Buddha? One who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. One who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The Dhamma's alive. We have the Buddha's teachings in these suttas. We're living in the time of the Buddha. Absolutely. We have people who are practicing really, really well and attaining the same insights that the Buddha had, getting into the same depth of meditation that the Buddha did. So the Buddha's teachings are very much alive. We're living in the time of the Buddha. All right, so it's our job to try to embody some of the qualities of a Buddha. even imagine what it might be like to be a Buddha or to be around a Buddha. And just let that inspire your mind. Let it really uplift you. Oh, I love talking like this. Yeah, the Buddha had the foresight to teach out of compassion for the sake of future generations, and that's us. He knew we'd be here, maybe not on Zoom, but, you know, somewhere. So glad that you could be here today. Thank you for being here and, yeah, for contributing fantastic questions. And, yeah, look up some of those notes in the chat. Maybe Minori, could you, I love that poem, by the way, Please Call Me By My True Names. It's not like I'm a big Thich Nhat Hanh fan, but I love that poem. It's actually my favourite poem, like, ever. It's just so moving. Check that out. See if you can find this woman as well. I think it's Dia. Dia Khan, I'm pretty sure. She's awesome. And maybe the book as well that... yeah, and nonviolent communication is great. Combined with practice, it's wonderful. And where's the book recommendation from Benjamin? I hope that's there. Wouldn't mind reading it out. Where is it? How Minds Change for the Sake of the Recording by David McCraney. Sounds very interesting. McRaney. How Minds Change. There's also a lovely book I'm reading at the moment called Humankind, which is really wonderful. And it's talking about humans being basically kind. And it's very much founded on research and history. And history going back like 30,000 years. So it's really fascinating. Great. So it's Dia Khan. Yeah, I just put the H in the wrong place. Super. I feel like watching her film, actually. It's deeply moving. All right, so I'll hand over to Manoi, supposed to say a few words to end, and then I'll let you know what's coming next. So if you can just stay with us for another few minutes.
Yeah, thank you very much, Venerable. It was such a wonderful teaching. And so I'd like to take this opportunity to take a few words about dana. So dana is generosity, and this is an opportunity for us to improve that quality within us, and then it will link to our Dhamma practice, create a good foundation of our Dhamma practice. So anukampa offers several ways that we can cultivate this beautiful quality. So the easiest thing is the donation, the financial donation. I'll just put a link. And so if you go, the link will take you to the website and you can do a financial donation of a bank transfer by PayPal or SumUp. It doesn't matter how much it is, you know, all the little things add up. And if you're financially able, you can do a regular donation, a standing order through the banking organization. Or else there are many non-financial activities that you can help us. You can do volunteering. So if you email team@anukampaproject.org, that is in the chat now, you can talk and see if you have any skills and time both, and you can discuss and see whether we need those skills. And also there you can provide meals to monastics, either a cooked meal or remotely. So this is something very big in the Eastern countries and Buddhist countries, providing food for monastics, whether they have it or don't have it, whether they had 10 meals or not. It is like a good karma. So it is something new for the West, I suppose. If you are far away, you can do it remotely, or sending groceries and other household items. There is a needed items list as well on the website, and the website is packed up with a list of the regular teachings and one-off teachings by Venerable. So please go and have a look at the events page of the website as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And I just remembered that for anyone who's local, We're hoping to come down, we'll confirm it, but we're hoping to come down into Oxford by foot from Boars Hill, which is about an hour and 40 minutes, and come with our bowls and go to the farmer's market and see if anyone's going to feed us. So I don't suppose you can fly from Germany or wherever else you are, Israel, or I don't know where else. Is anyone from America? Yeah, America, you can't probably do it. But if you're local or if you're semi-local, get in touch or just hang out at the farmer's market. It's where the buses go. Is it called something green, isn't it?
Gloucester Green.
Yeah, Gloucester Green. Not far from the train station in Oxford, like 10 minutes walk max. And it's Wednesday, the 3rd of June. It's the first time we're doing it, so we do hope someone will come and put food in our bowls.
What time will you be there?
We'll be there by 10, I should think, because even a bit earlier, probably. I don't know what time it actually opens, but we want to eat our lunch by 11, 11.30, 12 at the latest. We will have, like, a couple of lay people with us, but we don't really want to have to fall back on them, you know, because, yeah, I can't skip a meal because of my gastric problems. But, we don't really want to be ending up in some sort of sushi bar or something. It'd be nice to give people the chance to put food in our bowls. So anyway, we'll see how it goes and I'll let you know. It'll be fun. So tomorrow is Saturday. We don't have a metta meditation because we're having a half day retreat here. I think some of you might be coming, Benjamin, maybe, and Heather. Great, we get to meet Heather at last. Excellent. Yeah, make sure you catch me at the end. Might not get time to talk to you beforehand, but if you can stay on a bit and say hello. What else is happening soon?
Vesak
on the 30th of May. So that's an Oxford event as well. If you can come along for that, it's from 10 till 4:30, so it's worth coming for if you're in England at least. I do have another teaching with Bernd Sajato, as in the only one, because he didn't come for the other two. So I wasn't sure if I should do it, but he's promising me he was coming. And that's actually, I don't think that's live stream. It's for Clear Mountain. I think they record it actually and they put it on later. So, but that's talking about our favourite suttas. What else? Ajabramali is coming. We haven't sent online links for the Vesak. Maybe we should. But then it means putting them out soon in the newsletter. I don't know if we've got time to do it, to be honest. But we'll record it if not. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we've got time to put a newsletter out with an online link. But if we do get the time, we will. Otherwise, we'll record it. Okay. I think we can record it, at least parts of it. Next week, Sutta class again. So come along if you enjoyed this. And I'm sure I'm forgetting lots, but there will be updates in the newsletter. So we do have another talk by Ajahn Brahm as well. It's really weird because normally I used to have to squeeze out of him like 14, 15 days. And this year I'm like, oh, so you want to leave on the 24th, Ajahn? Okay. And then next week he's like, oh, I'll leave on the 25th. And then a couple of months later he's like, oh, yeah, that's okay. I'll leave on the 26th. He sort of almost asked me to stay an extra day. So we actually have an extra talk at the end of Ajahn Brahm's visit, which is good because it's a London-based talk. And everything else is Oxford, pretty much, and retreat. So there'll be a London-based talk at Kagyu Samyazong, that's like in Bermondsey, on the 25th of November. Okay? The day before he flies home. So, wonderful. I think I have to let you go. We're a bit late, but it's really nice to be here with you. I feel really inspired myself. So take care, everyone. You can unmute yourself if you wish and wave goodbye.